For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Morning, everybody. Many of you know of the very eminent forebearer, practitioner, teacher, Zhaozhou, who is a Tang Dynasty person. Zhaozhou said many interesting things. One of the things that he said was, "I do not take refuge in clarity." It's interesting to speculate. We don't know exactly what the limits of such people are. But you do have to ask yourself, whether he had a choice. Maybe he was simply making a virtue of necessity. As Dogen says, our realization is defined, limited by how far our eye of practice can see. And there is always a beyond. And therefore, there's always our clarity, our understandings, our realizations are conditioned, provisional, temporary, to be outgrown. So I put that forward as one sort of way to kind of frame the talk I'm going to give. The other person I would like to bring forward is Gary Snyder, whom many of you, I'm sure, know. But let me ask, are there people here who are not familiar with Gary Snyder? And please be honest. Great, thank you. Gary Snyder, there are many things you could say about him. I guess the main thing to say here is that he's I believe he's 90 now, nearing the end of his life, but he is a very important 20th century, primarily, American poet who is also one of the early people from our country who actually went and trained in a Zen monastery for, I think, about 10 years, and then came back to the United States to continue his work as a poet. He's written a lot of poetry, a lot of very, very interesting essays, one collection of which is called The Real Work. And in one of the essays in there, he quotes his own teacher, a fellow named Oda Sessel, who says, "In Zen, there are only two things. You sit and you sweep the garden. Doesn't matter how big the garden is." I suppose we can sort of imagine the situation, and maybe it's like, as sometimes happens in Zen monastic situations, somebody's giving a job, probably Gary Snyder, go out and sweep the garden, in the next, in the available 10 minutes we have here in the break. And he's like, "Whoa, that's too big." And so it said, it doesn't matter how big it is. Maybe it was that. But I think the probably better way to understand it, or a way to understand it together with that, is that we determine the boundaries of our lives, the field in which we think we can adequately, what we can adequately attend, care for. And those boundaries may be very different for each of us. And that's for us to find in our practice. But it doesn't matter how big the garden is. In Gary Snyder's case, one of the things he became known for is developing a body of thought called bioregionalism that, you know, in some sense we could say for Gary Snyder, the garden, the size of the garden is defined by the size of a particular watershed in the Sierra Nevada mountains in California that he's based his life in, and among the many other things that he does, is committed to that as a unit of time and space that he wants to take care of. In traditional Zen monastic life, a temple is bounded by walls, and for the most part, that is where a practitioner's activities unfold, sitting zazen and working on the grounds or in the kitchen and so on, sweeping the garden. But as Gary Snyder's life and work shows, the garden, you know, the temple, the field in which our practice can unfold, the field to which we can apply attentive effort and concern, can, practically speaking, be much larger. In principle, its boundaries can never be discerned. And I say it's a matter of principle. It's not that we just have to put further work in and we will find the boundary of the world. We won't. As Dogen observes, a bird could fly forever and never reach the end of the sky. And a fish will never exhaust the water. And so it is with us. Although it is not clear to me what it is exactly that Dogen is suggesting our realm is. It could be Dharma, language, desire, suffering, all of these things. There are so many ways to characterize, you know, the medium in which our lives, or media, I don't know, in which our lives unfold. Pardon me, for which we will never find boundaries. One of the early koans in the Book of Serenity, case 4, unfolds something like this. The Buddha was walking with his companions, and he points to the ground, and he says, "This would be a good place to build a sanctuary, to build a temple." One of his companions, it just happened to be Indra, king of the gods, plucks a stem of grass, picks a growing piece of grass, and plants it back in the ground and says, "The temple has been built." And the story closes by noting that Shakyamuni smiled. I love the temple, the sanctuary, in this story. The single blade of grass planted in the ground, it seems to be a simple declaration that says, here, now, and then looks out to the entire world, everything that falls within the eye of practice to say, all of this is the field. Nothing is enclosed, nothing is shut out, and nothing in the story indicates that the characters stopped walking, stopped moving through the world. We too continue to walk, always moving in time and space without any perception of where exactly the boundaries are, or even who it is that's walking in it. When I arrived here in this world with some kind of awareness, you know, I suppose, you know, I don't know, where does that begin? I found that there was already, you know, blood coursing through my veins. There's already air coming in and out. There was this language that I was growing into. My mom was feeding me, you know, and all of the things that make up my world were present there even before I could come close to thinking, I'm drawing this breath. This is my blood. My name is Eric. You know, I want to tell my mom that I need a cookie. You know, whatever that is. It was all here before me. It's an inheritance, and then something that I take forward and express in my own life. You know, so where does it all come from? You know, we could think about this in many ways, but okay, you know, I had parents. They had theirs, and their parents had their parents. And if we go back only 10 generations, right, which of course is hardly anything at all, there are 4,096 people involved in this chain. I worked it out. If we could spatialize this, you know, so that I could hold my mother's hand and she could hold her mother's hand and so on, so that rather than going back in time, these people are standing side by side. By the time we got to Milwaukee, which is, of course, hardly any distance at all, we would have covered thousands of generations, you know, millions of beings involved. But at the end of that chain, about at Milwaukee, in about 98 miles, according to this one thing I said, you know, the two beings holding hands would no longer be human, right? It would be some other hominid, right? Things change over time. You know, and that, you know, it becomes just incalculable. You know, you really, really can't determine how many countless beings brought you to this place. And of course, as you continue to go back, again, just a speck, you know, in the sweep of what we know about time, maybe 30,000 years ago, you get modern humans, you know, Homo sapiens, 300,000 years ago, Homo erectus, 900,000 years ago, hominids, 2.5 million years ago. And all this is still really, really new, you know, really, really is. The point being that, well, there are a couple, you know, it's an example of how, you know, we talk about our families. I can give you my mom's name, I can give you my grandparents' name, great-grandparents' name, but in almost anything that we look, any direction we look, we very quickly come to the limits of some kind of comprehensibility, any kind of true appreciation, except for in abstract terms. This applies to time, to space, to beings. Just a corollary, you know, that I will note, and it's important because we, you know, in Dharma, we often say, well, we are, you know, everything's related, all of us are related. And that's much, much truer in some ways than we can even begin to imagine. You know, given these kinds of geometrically expanding numbers, it's very unlikely that we would go back very far at all before we would, all of us in this room, quite literally find a common ancestor, and a stunningly short time before everybody in the world would be able to identify an ancestor. There's a very, Richard Dawkins has made this calculation, and it's not so far away. And of course, this applies to, as indicated by going back to this chain, and all of a sudden we recognize, well, these are not exactly humans anymore. This extends all the way back. In fact, it applies, you know, everybody had a mom, right? So that if we follow this idea, it's very clear that we are actually, you know, have a very direct connection, relative connection, with all the beings here in the world. In that chain, there's no discrete point at which we could say of any particular mother or child, oh, you know, mom's Homo erectus, but that child, woo, Homo sapiens for sure. It doesn't work that way. Or, you know, she's a modern human like me, but her mother was not. I mean, it just doesn't work that way. Rather, there's this endless chain of transformation, call it evolution, upon which we somewhat arbitrarily apply this skein of definition and category, right? Likewise, for myself as a person in these last 65 years, you know, I knew my mother before I knew I was called Eric, certainly. You know, and since then, there's been this endless transformation, endless continuities and discontinuities. But there's no point in these years. You know, even though I've always answered to this name, there's no point in which it would have been possible to use Buddha's words, apprehend a self. Instead, at any moment, what I would find is a shifting, provisional coming together of causes and conditions, a blade of grass standing out in a field from which I'm always moving away, you know, moving into further time, further development, further transformation. You know, so there's, just as there's no point in which we say human, homo erectus, that kind of distinction, there's no point in which I have ever arrived either, and never will. There's a wonderful word in Sanskrit. Many of us in this room love to say it. We've been getting it wrong, it turns out. It is anutpatika dharma kshanti. It does not mean, it turns out, as I've understood and others I know have, that it means toleration, tolerance of ungraspability, patience in the face of ungraspability, incomprehensibility, and so on. I'll clarify this in a minute, you know, what it does mean, or what the word we want for that. But it means instead toleration of the birthlessness of all things. And deals with the fact that, as the Heart Sutra says, dharmas neither arise nor cease. There is never that moment when, you know, something called Homo erectus morphs into Homo sapiens. There's never a moment when Eric or Niosan fully arrives. In each case, there's only this relatively stable, very constricted, you know, provisional relative statements that boil down to, you know, this, here, now. That is, anupatika dharmika shanti, it's a recognition that no phenomenon has intrinsic nature. In other words, it's a recognition of emptiness, is one way to think of it. Things are, you know, dharmas arise and fall, we say. But there really is, you know, this is Diamond Sutra, Heart Sutra stuff. There is no dharma that arise and falls. It's really only the arising and the falling, this play of causes and conditions. As a kind of lightweight intellectual exercise, we can find our way to this fairly easily. But what about the other part of the compound kshanti? Why do we talk about that? Because truly coming to grips with the birthlessness of things in this sense, with the idea of endless, non-ceasing transformation, coming to grips with the birthlessness of things, is not for the faint of heart necessarily. That is why in some, you know, when we have these schemas of staged practice, as we get in some of these sutras, in Mahayana, it is oftentimes considered a rather advanced bodhisattvic achievement. It's sometimes put at the eighth bhumi. Sometimes it's put at the first stage, the first bhumi. But to come to terms with this and actually seeing the world in these terms can be radically destabilizing, and it can take time. I said before that many of us have been a bit confused about the word anupatika dharmika shanti, and thinking it means ungraspability. Actually, the word we are looking for here is anupalabdhi dharmika shanti. And those are actually, they're very closely related. In Yogacara philosophy, one of the mainstreams of Mahayana philosophy, it means something like perception without bifurcation to subject and object, i.e. perception without a subject. In Madhyamaka, the other mainstream, it means perception without the imputation of intrinsic existence to what we perceive. You know, but in both cases, they come to the same point in this regard. There's a sense of getting rid of spurious dichotomization, spurious in the sense that even though we need to engage in it provisionally, always, it is, that's never the way things really are. This is the domain of skillful means, and it behooves us in our practice to come to grips with this. I'd like to quote Robert Thurman here. Many of you people know him. He's a longtime Tibetan practitioner. And this is, just by the way, this distinction between Abdulabdhi Dharmakashanti and Anupatika Dharmakashanti. It was in his introduction to the Vimalakirti Sutra that I first became alert to this. And then there are very good sections in the excellent Princeton Dictionary of Buddhism. So any of you who want to follow this and look it up. But Thurman says, in regard to Anupatika Dharmakashanti, that the term kashanti, patience, toleration, one of the paramitas, forbearance, he says, the mind is unable to grasp anything in the patterns of dualistic knowledge, for there is no finite object, and only relative objects can be grasped with relative certainty in the mundane case, in the mundane sense. When we reflect intensively on this, he goes on, our minds gradually open in an ever-widening sphere whose limits proceed from preconceived limitation to preconceived limitation. We discover to our surprise that there was always something further, and we logically discard the possibility of any limit being ultimate, because any limit serves as only the near boundary of the next larger space or dimension of time. If we adhere rigorously to this process, we soon find ourselves lost in the stars, just as we find ourselves lost in imagining our forebears. Lost in the stars, as it were, with less and less security about ever having started from anywhere. It takes time for such a process to permeate one's whole being, for this can be a shattering experience. The Princeton Dictionary of Buddhism says of Anupatika Dharmakashanti, and again, it's a rather long quote, this conviction concerning emptiness is characterized as a kind of acquiescence, forbearance, tolerance, etc., receptivity or forbearance, kshanti, because it sustains the bodhisattva, the practitioner, in the long and arduous path of benefiting others, instilling an indefatigable equipoise, and preventing him from, him or her, from falling back into the selfish preoccupation with personal liberation. The bodhisattva bears or acquiesces to the difficulty of actively entering the world to save others by residing in the realization that ultimately there is no one saving others and no one being saved. In other words, all dharmas, including sentient beings and the rounds of rebirth, are originally and eternally unproduced or tranquil. This realization of non-duality of the self and others, of samsara and nirvana, inoculates the bodhisattva from being tempted into premature attainment of cessation. This is the Mahayana critique of so-called Hinayana approaches, wherein one would escape from personal suffering through the extinction of continual existence, but at the cost of being deprived of the chance to attain an even greater goal of Buddhahood through sustained practice along the bodhisattva path. Earlier, I alluded to evolution with the talk about hominids and Homo erectus, all these things. We have the image of the tree of life, rooted in deep time. We've all seen this, ever branching and differentiating until, boom, there's a leaf called Pala, here's a leaf called Nyosan, here's a leaf called Hogetsu. The outer edge of this continuing and massively temporally deep process, right? And this is an incredibly useful image. It's in many ways a true image. It can open our understanding up. But it's also possible and perhaps useful to reverse it entirely. And rather than seeing ourselves only as sort of the insignificant tail end of this massively moral process, we can see that actually being those leaves, being at the end of means that rather than, you know, this root from which everything branches out, it's as if there are this infinite number of streams of causes and conditions, and it winds up exactly here, exactly in each of your seats, to this blade of grass. All of this stuff that has been, it's precisely this now. All those other beings have neither come and gone. They're all sitting on these cushions in Irving Park Road, as it says in one of our chants of the Dharma, equally true here. Now we have it. Preserve it well. All these other beings aren't somewhere else. I started with the notion of sweeping the garden. Otis Fesso says that it doesn't matter how big the garden is. I think the idea is that it is up to each of us to determine where we will sweep, what we will take care of, how we will live our lives. In a sense, we are in a position, that position of the blade of grass planted in the earth, looking out with no ascertainable boundaries and enormous responsibility. We take the bodhisattva vow. This could be kind of overwhelming, possibly even self-defeating. Hence the need for kshanti, for patience, for toleration, for stability. Do we sweep this temple? Is that the focus of our concern? Do we address ourselves to much larger fields of activity? The environmental crisis, the climate crisis. It turns out we can't make a policy about this. You know, it really is up to each person to sort of work out for themselves what exactly is the field in which they can unfold their practice of zazen and precepts, skillful means, right? Do we pay attention to only people? Do we expend ourselves on the benefit of trees? Well, people do both, and that's wonderful. In practical terms, these kinds of questions are worked out in living our lives, and it'll play out differently according to our talents and proclivities. Dogen says of the fish and the bird, when their activity is large, their field is large. When their need is small, their field is small. Thus, each of them totally covers its full range, and each of them totally experiences its realm. And that, so it is for us. But always, if we open ourselves to it, we can see that no one and no place within that field, which for most of us expands, can be excluded. However we bound the practice that we are willing to attend to, the garden that we are willing to attend to, we need to recognize that our world is not fundamentally graspable in any sense. We've been given effective means for cultivating this kind of a place, and this is the Dharma. You know, what did Zhao Zhou do with his situation of lack of clarity, lack of graspability, lack of comprehension? He practiced meditation, engagement with the precepts. And I think that for those of us who undertake practice, no matter how far we wander or whatever circumstances we find ourselves in, these will stand us in good stead. Even though there is always a frame beyond which we can see, beyond which we can comprehend, it turns out that if we expose ourselves to it and take them on, that we have a whole range of practices that allow us to be in the circumstances that we're in, even flourish in the circumstances we're in, even if they, you know, become personally challenging, even though in this time our, you know, broader social, political circumstances are very, very disturbing and frightening, threatening. We have the same tools that Zhao Zhou had. And I guess I'll let it end there. And if there are any comments or whatever, by all means. Hi.
Just a little Gary Snyder quote, which brings some closure, the size of the garden and how to make choices related to that and related to the problems of the world. Make a temple of a blade of grass. Gary Snyder was asked, what should we do about climate change? He said, stay put.
Yeah. Thank you. Kathy. I'm sorry, once more.
Choices about where to be. I've been in the last 3 years, it's much bigger than I had before. And it was completely overgrown. And it's taken 3 years to begin to have it not be overgrown. But as you're, you know, choosing, sometimes it's overwhelming. You know, I don't have thousands of dollars to pay a staff to change this into a garden. And so it's kind of like, it's overwhelming at times. It's like, why am I doing this? It still looks a mess. but over time, it is shifting gradually, and there's more and more. And I guess the parallel is when we are trying to decide what to take on in our lives, sometimes it's overwhelming. We can do a little something and it's like, it's still a mess. And you have to do it not wanting results, but not requiring results.
I'm reminded of the story that you all would have heard, many of you, and I can't remember the person who's involved, but it was after a session, and the teacher says something to his students, well, when you leave the temple, go find some place where a blade of grass does not grow for 1,000 li, whatever that unit is. I think it's about 2/3 of a mile. One of the students responds, you know, or actually one of the students responds that, well, you know, as soon as you go out the temple gate, grass is growing. And then a later commentator added in, you know, you don't even have to go outside the gate. It's, you know, it's already the weeds, fresh weeds appear everywhere. Alex. Oh, really?
Those two words are related.
Oh, wow. Thank you.